I mean, for Janice or anyone would do absolutely nothing, because this was just another path she had chosen to walk down, remember? From now on, she was choosing everything that filled her, and right now it was nothing. Right now it was Pete. Right now it was a thing she had to do to earn the warm syrup of smoke coating her insides with glitter paint. This slow, syrupy world gave her all the time she needed to understand what to do next. It was like she was in a bubble with the man named Pete and the sleeping bag and the pigeons and the cars whose headlights never illuminated the place behind the pillar for more than a quarter of a second. But in those flashes, she saw that Pete had fists and that there was a knife concealed in his pockets. And why wouldn't there be? It wouldn't be the first wicked blade she had stolen. Baby lay still, waiting for it to be over. Nothing watched for an angle. 13. I watch her all week long, waiting for something to happen. Now I am thankful for her short red hair, which both reveals and defamiliarizes her face. I retrace its contours, not with a mother's intimate knowledge, but with a stranger's curiosity. I try not to superimpose the real Julie over the false Julie, compare line to line, but rather to learn every curve and dimple anew. Her chin is fine and pointed, but her jaw is sharper and squarer than it looks at first glance. Her forehead higher and shadowed with the very first creases that no amount of blank facing will completely smooth away. I try to determine the degree of the slight angle between the bridge and the tip of her nose, trace the flanges of her nostrils. I do not look at her eyes if I can avoid it. Too dangerous. She'll feel me looking, and I'll feel something that may or may not be real. Even so, I'm making her uneasy. She drops a glass in the sink Wednesday morning, and it shatters. Tom has to take her by the shoulders and move her aside so he can clean it up. She runs to her room and closes the door, dramatically but as quietly as if she's performing a role in a silent film. She can get up and down the stairs with hardly a creak or thump. I wonder if she is pacing in her bedroom. If so, we hear nothing of it downstairs. Tom and I don't talk about it. We haven't spoken since Monday, and he sleeps in Jane's empty room, where he has moved his computer desk. I assume he works in there during the day. Perhaps Julie comes and goes while Tom stares at his screen and tries not to notice. As for me, I go to work too. Once I'm in my office, door locked against the department secretary, I'm oblivious to faculty and students passing in the halls. Nothing can hurt me. I put my cell phone on my desk and lay my head down next to it, waiting for Alex to call, waiting for news about the DNA test. Sometimes I grow impatient and imagine calling the police myself, telling them my doubts about the woman in my house. Things would move much more quickly after that. But I threw Overby's number away, and finding it again would take more willpower than I have at my disposal. Besides, this way, like Alex said, I don't have to be involved. She'll never know it was me. That's the beauty of IDing a corpse rather than a living girl. And what will happen when they get the results? I imagine the police bursting into the house, ready to cuff her and drag her away. She's sitting on the sofa under the afghan watching a movie. She turns around at the noise. I try to inoculate myself against the expression on her face as they come for her. Shock? Rage? But I never see it. Instead, I keep seeing her expression illuminated by the ultrasound screen. Bottomless grief. Hopeless despair. And what if I'm wrong? But these are the habits of denial. When I feel myself starting to indulge them, I force myself to think of the photo. It's a short trip from there to thoughts of Tom's gun. When did Tom take the classes? When did he get a license to own a handgun? Just another thing he was doing on his own, though I know it doesn't take long. I know because I once planned to buy one. I told myself that's why I went to the firing range. I was practicing to get my license, firing rounds into a piece of paper shaped like a man for entirely pragmatic reasons. If something like that ever happened again, I told myself, I wanted to be ready. It was a lie. I wanted to pretend, in every possible scenario, that I was killing him. Every time the gun discharged and I felt the jolt go through me, I felt exhilaration at the thought that maybe I had missed the heart, hit a shoulder or a knee or the groin so I could have the chance to do it again and again. I wanted to kill him forever. One day when I drove to the firing range, I realized it wasn't really Julie's abductor I wanted to kill. It was someone else. The person who was really to blame for Julie's death. And even if she wasn't to blame, she was the only person I could hold accountable. A firing range is the easiest place in the world to kill yourself. You don't have to own a firearm to shoot one. It was raining hard, one of those summer downpours where the air feels inside out like a monsoon, and I almost wrecked the car getting there. I was too drunk to write my name on the sign-in sheet that day, and they turned me away. I never went back. That was the beginning of the end of the drinking, and when I sobered up, I decided not to buy a gun. But there are laws of inevitability at work in our lives. While I was crying drunkenly in my car, shuddering away from the brink, Tom, somewhere across the city, was making a different decision. And now the gun is in our house, like it was always meant to be. Now that I've lost her again, I can always use it. Friday night after dinner, Tom goes up to Jane's room and shuts the door, while I sit on the sofa and idly browse the cable channels. Something has to give. Something has to break. I believe it will happen tonight. Halfway into a rerun of Roseanne, Julie confirms it by striding quickly past the sofa on her way out. I hear the garage door open, catch a glimpse through the kitchen window of Tom's car backing out. Leaving the television on, I wait a few seconds and follow her in my car. At night, the freeway is less clogged, and the rosary beads flash past instead of scrolling slowly by. The faded awnings and new construction and apartment buildings look flat and dull at night, irrelevant. I can barely distinguish one from the other. Up ahead, the Range Rover weaves expertly around slower cars, in and out of lanes. Julie's a good driver for someone who's only just learned, I think to myself with some sarcasm. Though there are plenty of cars on the road, I can always see her. The SUV sticks out over the other cars, highly visible even to me in my squat little Prius. I know where she's going before she puts on the turn signal. At night, the gate is a bald hill wreathed in glowing glass. The surface parking lot is full. There's something going on, one of the nighttime services that are among the church's most heavily attended offerings. I turn into the garage, where suited attendants direct a line of creeping cars farther and farther up, and a steady stream of people flows back down a central staircase from the roof. I go where I'm directed, ascending past thousands of cars to the top level of the garage. Every time I pass the staircase, I glance at the line of people, and just as I'm turning the corner to the top level, driving toward the open spots in the distance, I finally catch a glimpse of Julie, heading downward with the rest of the crowd. She's wearing a long skirt and cardigan I bought her just a few weeks ago, when things were so different. I park and walk down the staircase with the rest of the stragglers. A lean, older couple wearing matching denim shirts and shining belt buckles. The woman carrying a leather purse dangling fat silver charms. A black woman about my age in jeans and a ruffled blouse, herding two children in front of her. An elderly woman with a cane, a towering Latino man with a potbelly and a bullet-shaped head who pushes past everyone impatiently. All of us emerge together onto the surface lot, then stream down a walkway to the lobby, which is teeming with people. The hanging monitors and clerestory lighting feel different at night. Surrounded by the faintest hint of a stadium echo that no amount of plush carpet and soft, shaggy area rugs can dampen, it makes the air feel a little fizzy so that it's obvious this structure was originally built for excitement. The escalators that cleave the entryway in half are covered with people, but I don't see Julie anywhere. I hurry past the information desk and step onto the escalator to avoid the enthusiastic greeters, only to be delivered straight into the hands of a thin woman with large, bright-awake eyes behind oversized glasses at the top of the escalator.
"Program?"
I take the glossy trifold, still scanning the crowded horizon for Julie, and she spots my hesitation.
"Is this your first time visiting?"
she asks with a heavy Houston accent, flattening the vowels, chewing and pinching off the consonants. Yes, I nod, and she puts her hand on my forearm.
Well, listen, honey, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go right back down this escalator, and you see that desk on your right? Well, now, usually Sheena is up here at the top of the stairs with me, but you can see her down there.
I start to panic. What if Julie sees me stopped here at the top of the escalator? Can I just seat myself?
Of course, honey,
she says, but then calls after me as I'm moving away.
It's just since you're new, we'd rather you got one of the really good seats.
For my money, a good seat is one where you can see the lay of the land without attracting attention. I walk around the stadium's curve on the second floor, following the flow of people past a room with a sign saying Communion, more video screens, and an unmanned, recessed information booth that used to be a concession stand or bar when this was a stadium. Then I step into the sanctuary itself. It is cavernously huge. Cluster lights illuminate dust motes 100 feet away against the bluish-black vault of what used to be the Astrodome. Only the intricate starburst pattern of rectangular skylights on the ceiling hinting at its former identity. Gone is the astroturf, replaced by acres of beige carpet. The folding seats lining the walls have been tastefully reupholstered in navy. Jumbotron screens flank the stage, and a TV camera on a crane swoops over the red-carpeted dais as if it's limbering up for the show. I find a seat halfway down the top section, close to the aisle, and sit down. After a few minutes, the lights dim, and the stadium, still steadily filling with people, erupts into applause. Audience members stand in waves, shouting, "Jesus lives!" and "Praise Him!" over the band, which has started up a dramatic, throbbing hum. 7 singers emerge from the depths of the altar, dressed in television-friendly stage outfits and holding wireless mics. All at once, the music bursts out, a heavy beat thrumming through the whole stadium, as loud as any rock concert, basketball game, or monster truck rally. The laser light show begins, brilliant beams of green and blue sweeping the stadium. One moves across my face for a split second, and I feel a shot of adrenaline, the chemical response to being bathed suddenly and forcefully in a powerful light. My heart feels as if it's actually leaping up. Like in the Wordsworth poem. I've always wondered what that would be like. The music thuds explosively onward. It's a soaring pop anthem, the song you hear near the end of a film about teenagers in love. The jumbotrons cut between the singers' faces, the band sweatily playing their instruments, and a montage of images. Fast-motion sunsets and sunrises, flowers opening in a tenth of a second, young people driving a jeep across dunes, a beautiful blonde girl lying on her back beside a campfire, a black baby stumbling forward on chubby legs, while a white woman kneels with her hands out, a sailboat speeding across a giant lake in time with the clouds. After a few minutes of this, the singers part and recede around a lone figure who walks to the front of the stage. The people begin pumping their fists, the cries of "Praise Him!" louder and louder.
"I am here for you," he says simply. "And so is the Lord."
I recognize the voice from the Circle of Healing, but this is my first glimpse of Chuck Maxwell in person. He looks like a country pop singer at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, or the long-lost father on a soap opera. The jumbotron gives me a close-up of the kindest, crinkliest pair of blue eyes I have ever seen.
"I'm here to tell you, the Lord has great things in store for you, His children," Maxwell says to screaming and applause, "and you're here for one reason, to listen, to know, and to praise His holy name. Because nothing happens by chance in this great universe the Lord has made. He's bigger than your problems, and when He calls your name, they'll be gone."
"Amen,"
a voice just behind me yells out. Maxwell pauses and lets them scream for a while, a smile crinkling his beard around his neck.
"Listen," he says.
Another dramatic pause. The music is swelling and people are shifting from side to side, shaking their heads back and forth.
"Tell it, Chuck,"
a voice rings out.
"I will tell it, I will," he yells. "Why are you here today, people? Let me just ask you that. Why are you here?"
He puts the microphone out and cups his other hand behind his ear as the audience yells in one voice,
"It ain't luck, Chuck."
He puts the mic back by his beard and says,
That's right, y'all. It ain't luck. Nothing is luck in this universe the Lord has made for us. He loves each and every one of us. We are all his very special favorites, and he will bring us something that is beyond our imagining very soon. And whatever it is he has in store for us, y'all, he pauses again, it's gonna be worth it.
The screaming and clapping erupts once more, and the singers melt forward to begin a song, obscuring him from view temporarily. The man sitting to my left taps my shoulder and hands over a blue plastic bucket filled with envelopes and cash, a crisp $100 bill sitting at the top of the pile. I pass the bucket to the usher at the end of the aisle, who smiles beatifically at me, although I haven't put anything in.
Y'all, his blessings are gonna rain down upon us, says Maxwell confidingly as the music subsides.
I know you're worried. I know you've got the day job, or the sick kid, or the people coming after you about the bills. I know you've got the son-in-law who hasn't come to Jesus yet. You turn on the news and you think, this world is getting darker, turning its face from God. I'm here to tell you some of the best news of all.
Don't worry about it. Let the Lord look after your neighbor and your kid and your landlord and your boss. What you're waiting for is coming, and the only reason it hasn't come yet is your faith ain't strong enough yet.
The music starts up again, but this time slower, more hymn-like.
Now this next song, I and my team of prayer leaders will descend down off this stage, and anyone who wants to can come on up here and pray with us. Just go on up to the head of your section, and a prayer leader will listen to you and pray with you. Pray you get the wisdom to see what the Lord has already given you. And the rest of you can take your seats and just listen to these inspired singers tell you about God's love.
As the crowd rises as one and surges toward the dais, I begin to understand what the really good seats are good for. Lines form, filling the stadium floor and trailing up the aisles, while Maxwell and a handful of other elders begin quietly conferring with the first few who make it to the stage. I sweep my eyes back and forth, searching for a redhead in the crowd, but the stadium floor is rapidly becoming an undifferentiated mass of people milling forward for their personalized prayers. Just as I'm deciding this is an impossible task, there she is, on the prayer cam. The features I've been studying so minutely blown up and hanging overhead on a jumbotron screen. I watch, transfixed, as Maxwell appears next to her, his face tilted down toward hers, his eyebrows bent into a serious, compassionate expression, one hand resting on her shoulder. The redhead turns her face up toward his, stands on tiptoe until she's almost his height, and draws so close it looks like she's about to kiss him. She puts her lips to his ear and whispers something. Maxwell's expression changes dramatically. His eyes go suddenly wide, his eyebrows shoot upward, and his mouth opens in a gasp like he's been kneed in the groin. The camera cuts to someone else. I drag my gaze from the screen down to the stadium floor, desperate to find her before the moment is over. There she is, one hand steadying herself on Maxwell's padded jacket shoulder so she can stay on tiptoe, the other pointing a finger at his chest. He jerks backward as she sinks down to her heels and turns to walk away. Two men in suits who have been standing nearby emerge from the crowd and start moving toward her, but Maxwell gets there first. He lunges, grabs her forearm, and leans in close, his whole body tensed toward her, enfolding her in a terrible intimacy. He gives her arm a single shake, and she tears out of his grasp and pushes off to the side, losing the two bodyguards and my gaze in the crowd. When I look back at Maxwell, he's already talking to the next woman in line. Their foreheads so close they're almost touching. And yet even I can tell his mind isn't with the woman he's absolving. It's with Julie. And Julie is gone. I start up out of my seat to follow her, but then stop myself and sink back down again. She's on the ground floor, and I'm upstairs. By the time I get out of the gate, she'll be halfway to Tom's car, and I'm parked farther away than she is. Anyway, I have no idea what I've just seen, and thus no idea what I'd say if I caught up to her now. Only one thing is clear. Judging from Maxwell's alarmed expression and the ferocious intimacy of his body language on the stadium floor, they know each other. What did she whisper in his ear? A threat?
What could Julie possibly have on Maxwell?
Not Julie, I remind myself.
As the service comes to a close, the music swells and thunders. The screens flash and go black again. The slices of red dawn outline the gate logo, and in the grand finale, it opens. When the praise band finally decrescendos, the people around me look happily exhausted by the barrage of positivity. I stumble out, feeling emptied. Out in the night air, I check my phone. There's a new voicemail from 20 minutes ago. The signal must be spotty inside the concrete stadium because I never felt it buzz. Then I see the number and hurriedly put the phone to my ear to listen to the message.
Hi, Cal. It's Gretchen.
It's the same voice that cried,
Mom, Dad,
when she hugged us in the emergency room. The same voice that whispered,
You must have really wanted to find me,
before breaking into tears. And now this voice confesses out loud that she, the woman living in my house, is not my daughter. After everything I know, it shouldn't surprise me. But this is more damning than a fuzzy YouTube video. More damning even than a crime scene photo. Only now do I realize I've been holding on to some last slender thread of hope. These words, it's Gretchen, are the sound of its snapping. The message continues.
I need your help, Cal. I'm scared.
She starts crying.
If you're still at this number, you're in Houston. And if you found me here, maybe you already know everything about me. Maybe you know the worst.
She sobs thickly.
If you come for me after finding out the worst, I'll know you still love me. I'm going to the water wall to confront the man who did this to me. He'll be there at midnight. Please come. I don't want to go alone.
On the voicemail, there's the sound of a horn honking, followed by a clatter as if she's dropped the phone. Then,
Cal, I don't know if this makes any difference, but for a few weeks I think it was a girl.
The voicemail beeps. Press 7 to repeat this message. Press 8 to delete this message. Press 9 to save. I press 9. When I confront her, I want to have her own voice in my pocket as proof. By the time I reach my car, it's 11:35, and I know I have to find her now, tonight, before I lose my nerve, and demand to know what she's doing here, why she's tormenting my family. Now that I know Julie is only Gretchen after all, a blurry face on a YouTube video, a second-rate performer, an imposter, a fake, I have no choice. It's been Gretchen this whole time. And soon it will be midnight. She didn't feel the blow, but she felt the black. It was like water she was sinking into, or that was sinking into her. There was a redness at the top of it, and the closer she got to the red, the more it hurt. Whereas the black was as soft and lustrous blue-black as clouds of birds taking flight. The black was as soft and lustrous green-black as the ocean floor. The black was as soft as the black velvet pillow that swallows the diamond ring. The black was as black as her sleeping self. She swam toward the red. She fought redward, even though the black was trying to swallow her like a diamond. It was wrapping eyeless tendrils around her ankles and dragging her gently down. It was surrounding her with silent claws and carrying her into a blue-black sky. But every time she rested into its softness, she heard Charlotte screaming. Then there was a blow, and the screaming stopped. Then another noise, a mewling that didn't sound like Charlotte or like anyone. Was it her? Her tongue was dead in her mouth, a dead bird with blue-black wings. The noise went on, a gurgling, and then another thud that she felt inside her eyelids. If she concentrated every red particle of energy to her fingertips, she could just feel the ground. It was slick and hot and red. She could feel the red stinging her fingertips. Or maybe it wasn't a feeling, but a smell. A pointed smell that was both clean and dirty at the same time. It was the smell of losing a tooth, which was also a taste. Warm, electrified, metallic. She tried to pull her fingers back, but the birds had all been clubbed out of the air one by one, and she must be made of them from head to toe. So her dead bird fingers rested in the electric red pool that smelled like teeth. There were words being said, a litany, a prayer. They were being said in a voice she knew well, John David's voice, but they were angry. Maybe they were God's words, and it was God who was angry.
You little shit, goddamn little shit,
were the words said over and over again. The bird in her mouth twitched, and she knew it was alive after all. It wanted to scream. She clamped down hard.
What am I gonna do? What am I gonna do? What am I gonna do?
Thumping, retreating, ascending, and fading, he ascended into heaven. He had rolled the stone away, and now he was climbing the basement stairs into the sky. She opened her eyes. Charlotte lay crumpled before her, upside down, 4 feet away, staring at her through eyes filled with blood. She stared into Charlotte's upside-down eyes. They seemed full of wisdom. Charlotte was trying to tell her something. Charlotte was the brave one. Charlotte was the smart one. She had even stolen the wicked little blade from John David's trash can to saw through the duct tape. No, that was Julie who had stolen the blade. Charlotte wasn't looking into her eyes after all. She was looking at Julie's right hand, curled an inch from her face. She was staring at something Julie could feel lying under the back of her hand, digging into one knuckle with a sharp corner. A wicked little corner. When she moved her hand, the blade scraped the floor underneath, and then there it was. A cold slice of air a few inches from her face, doubled and blurred but unmistakable. Her left hand slid toward it, fingertips dragging electric trails through the red liquid that was even now less hot than it had been, even now just barely warmer than the air itself. Her bloody fingers closed around one side of the blade. Feet appeared on the stairs, and next to them, the head of an axe. For just a moment, she squinted her eyes shut again, just to remember what life was like when she didn't know that Charlotte was dead and she was next. An unexpected noise of retching came from the corner. She opened her eyes, and John David was on his knees, facing away from her and Charlotte. He was not praying. A puddle of vomit snaked away past John David's knees toward the place where the blood was, where she was. Before the puddle reached her, she was up on her feet. She hardly knew how she got there. Her head was like a cinder block, but she stacked it on top of her body and stacked her body on top of her legs, and then she was standing, towering over the broken doll that was Charlotte and the hunched figure of John David groaning in the corner. He spat, groaned again, and gasped for breath. A wave of dizziness swept over her suddenly, the red coming back to cloud her vision with blue-black dots swimming around the edges, threatening to rise up again like smoke. She put a bare foot out to steady herself, and the noise made the emptied-out John David whirl around on his knees, one hand still on the axe handle, one foot already making contact with the floor to push himself to standing. But as he pulled the other foot up, the heel of his boot came down in the snaky trail of vomit, and his boot shot out from under him like a Russian dancer's, and he landed hard on the hand still holding the axe, so hard that his full weight crushed his fingers between the axe handle and the floor, and he yelped in pain. She stood holding the razor blade out in front of her. But as he scrambled for purchase on the floor that was slippery with so much blood and vomit, she gave a cry and ran up the narrow stairs, not quite on all fours because she was still clutching the razor in her left hand, but almost, using her arms like in dreams of running on all fours, some kind of throwback, maybe, to a time when hands were useful for something more than holding a feebly small razor blade that, although wicked, was nothing in comparison to the vast, smiling cruelty of an axe. Her knees, her everything, was slippery with blood.
"Esther! Esther!"
The voice was behind her, beneath her, but how far?
"Esther, come back! I won't hurt you!"
She was at the top of the stairs, and he was at the bottom. She looked at him there, so tiny, and saw the beginnings of a bald spot coming out at the very top of his head. She had never been taller than him before.
"Esther!"
he cried again, but his hand was still on the axe, choked up now near the head. His voice grew wheedling.
"I never meant to hurt you, Esther. Charlotte was the bad one. I only knocked you out so you wouldn't have to see."
"My name's not Esther,"
she shouted, but it came out in a whisper.
"No,"
he agreed. She was shocked.
"It's Ruth, for you have seen much."
She stood stock still,
Ruth, he said, you have passed the test. You have made a blood sacrifice.
His tone had lost its frantic edge and grown soothing, honeyed.
You did the right thing, Ruth. She tried to run away, and you stopped her. Now we can be a happy family again, just you and me. You called for help. She overpowered you, and you called for help, and I came.
Although her head was swimming, she knew that was not what had happened at all. She shook her head to clear the cobwebs.
My name is Julie.
That was the only thing that made sense, but it made his hands tighten around the axe handle. She turned and ran just as he sprang up the stairs after her. His legs were longer than hers, but she darted around the corner just as he reached out to grab her ankle, the axe handle clattering clumsily against the stairs. She got around to the other side of the kitchen table as he appeared at the top of the stairs, but then realized she had pinned herself against the wall. He held the axe with both hands, shifting its weight from one to the other as if he enjoyed the feel of it in his palms.
"Don't make me kill you, Esther," he said.
"I thought my name was Ruth now,"
she said, this time forcing the words to come out loud and strong.
"Whoever you are," he yelled, "don't make me kill you because I will if I have to, but God does not want you dead."
"God is shit," Julie said.
"God is love and you are shit," he returned. "Never forget that."
He slammed the axe blade into the middle of the table, and the formica cracked down the center with the blade stuck in it. She grabbed the table from her side and shoved as hard as she could, just hard enough to make John David fall on his ass, the axe still in the table, and she almost laughed at how funny this was. But now John David was scrambling along the floor after her, grabbing for her ankles with his bare hands, knocking aside the chair she threw back at him until finally she was at the door. She managed to get one foot onto the concrete step before a hand grabbed the pitiful bedsheet that was still tangled around her like a robe. She tried to slam the screen door behind her, but it bounced on his arm. She leaned back as hard as she could, hurling her entire weight against the door. His hand jolted loose for an instant, but then the fingers gripped her upper arm and squeezed hard.
"I've got you,"
he said, panting, and his hot breath warmed her cheek through the screen door.
"I've got you."
He leaned hard on his side of the door, and she could feel his weight through the mesh, curiously soft and intimate against her own. And what a time to remember his bulk on her. What a time to remember those nightmare communions. What a time to suddenly feel more his than ever in this moment of almost freedom, a failed freedom.
"What happened here is your fault,"
he breathed through the mesh.
"You aren't Ruth. You aren't Esther. You're nothing."
But in her bloody hands, something wicked still remained. She slashed blindly with the blade at his fingers, and when they opened, she ran.
"Nothing, nothing, nothing. Nothing, 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 nothing."
She ran to the rhythm of what she was. There was something, though, curling right up in her core, and every pounding, naked footfall sent shockwaves through her legs to say hello to it.
"Goodbye," she told it. "I don't care," she told it. "You're nothing," she told it.
But she knew she was wrong. She remembered a distant promise of help, peaches in syrup, canned corn, and ran hopelessly toward it. Every ounce of effort went into not tripping on the uneven sidewalks, or getting smacked in the face with low-hanging branches, or tangling herself up in her sheet, which was trailing. She could not take the time to look back and see if he was 10 steps behind, 20, or none. One fall, and his hands could close around her throat. Bloody hands she'd slashed open herself with the wicked little blade. The same blade she'd used to commit the sin that could never be erased.
"Oh, Charlotte. Poor, poor Charlotte."
She ran through the old Houston neighborhood of hunched brick houses concealing God knows how many pulped skulls and ruined little girls. Houses with who knew how many buried secrets in the backyard, zigzagging crazily around corners. The quaint old fairy tale curves of the houses with their thick, climbing vines nauseated her, and she ran past them in search of the larger streets that would signify civilization and possibly help.
but the streets were eerily bare. Was it too early, even for morning walks? She emerged from the stifling neighborhood onto a corner with a stoplight and paused to catch her breath. A small park lay on her right next to a long rectangular building with a covered walkway running its whole length. She recognized the sculpture on the lawn, a canal of rusty metal sunk into the grass in a random, nonsensical pattern like a dropped ribbon, and vaguely remembered visiting this museum on a long-ago field trip. Looking around, she realized that it wasn't morning after all. Though the light was at half strength, and she felt that she'd lived through a long night, the colors weren't right for sunrise. The sky was a dingy, opaque white that made her feel as if she were still indoors, just in a bigger room. The trees loomed large, so dense and saturated with green, the color seemed to bleed off the edges of the leaves. That and the fact that the trees were absolutely motionless in the dead air made them look like fake trees on a stage set or in a dream. She ran into the empty street and, craning her neck to the right, saw a freeway. Then she saw it, towering above her, taller than the trees, taller than the lampposts. Missing. A girl. Blonde, beautiful, and pink-cheeked. It wasn't her. Nothing like. She looked at the billboard and then down at herself, barefoot, filthy after months in the dark with him and the things he'd done to her. And now she had the something that wasn't nothing curled up in her gut to remind her of those things. To remind her, too, of what she'd done to Charlotte. The girl on the billboard knew nothing about that. She was perfect. The next moment, as if someone had ripped a Band-Aid off the sky, a wall of rain fell down. In a few seconds, it made a river that flowed past her bare feet and hid the billboard almost completely. She started running again. By the time she got to the food pantry, the rain had slackened to a drizzle like laundry being squeezed out, and the sun was poking out from behind wet flannel clouds, making the last drops sparkle in midair. The ground was already starting to steam, but she shivered in front of the thin plywood stall. It was padlocked shut. "If you need anything," the woman with the peaches had said. She needed lots of things. Her stomach swam with a sickness that could attack her at any time of day, especially when she hadn't eaten. The only thing that kept her from vomiting was the thought of being found on her knees on the concrete, alone in front of the pantry stall. She circled around behind it. A figure leaned against the back of the pantry stall, sheltered behind it on the concrete slab, smoking a cigarette. The woman heard her and swiveled her head slowly in her direction, as if she anticipated being bored by the sight. She took her in from head to toe with a long look, exhaled and waited with the cigarette held between two fingers down by her knees. She seemed like she was used to waiting. Suddenly the woman snapped to attention and took another, quicker drag off her cigarette. Then she leveled it out in front of her, pointing.
"Wig girl," she said. "I know you. You're that wig girl. Where's your wig at?"
The girl opened her mouth to say something, but just then the cigarette smoke from the woman's outstretched hand caught the breeze and drifted toward her. The rush of nausea it induced sent her to her knees in the mud, and she puked into the long, wet grass behind the wooden stall. But there was nothing to puke, just acid that burned her throat. Afterward, she couldn't see anything but green and yellow flecks for a while, and then there was a moment of blackness before she felt a warm hand on the back of her neck.
"Wig girl, you don't look so good,"
the woman said as she helped her to a sitting position on the concrete. The flecks cleared, and she saw the woman's face more clearly. The weave was gone, and the woman's short black hair shot back away from her face in stiff little flames.
"My name's Janice, and your name's about to be Mama if I'm any judge."
The girl breathed in and out, taking long gulps of the now smoke-free air. "I ran away," she said, and then paused. She couldn't think of the words for what had happened. She'd lied. She'd killed. She'd tried to be good. She'd failed.
"Yeah, I got that," Janice said. "You got people you can go to?"
She shook her head.
"You need some clothes, a place to stay?"
She nodded.
"You need to get rid of that?"
Janice pointed. For a moment, she was confused.
"Whose baby you having, honey?"
the woman asked a little more softly. The retching came from so deep within her this time that she thought she would be torn to pieces. Except that wasn't even a possibility. To have pieces, you have to be something. Janice watched her as she came up wiping her mouth with the back of her hand.
Okay, then, never mind about that. You need some food in you either way.
She looked mutely toward the food pantry behind them.
Oh, hell no, said Janice. Rhonda's a nice lady, but one look at that 4 months gone belly, and she ain't letting you out of her sight. They got a room for you.
A room?
Look at that, it talks!
Yeah, they got a special room with a special movie.
They're Catholics. Understand? You don't want to mess with Catholics in your condition, shit.
She said if I needed...
If what you need is a lecture on keeping your legs closed, and I ain't saying you don't.
I need...
Every word felt pulled from a bottomless well. Sometimes the bucket hid water, and sometimes it went down and down and dangled in space.
I know what you need, and I can tell you right now you can't get it. Not without a bunch of papers signed by your folks back home. Hell, it's probably someone there did it to you in the first place.
Home. You're nothing.
Come on, you're coming with me.
Janice helped her up and sighed.
Whoever did that to you, I hope he rots in hell. Because getting it out is going to be a whole lot of trouble. Money,
too. A sideways glance.
But we'll talk about that part later.
She thought about hell. She thought about heaven. She thought about what was inside her, the life, the heartbeat. Then she thought about John David, his weight on top of her again and again. She hadn't crawled out of the hole after all. It was inside her. Its name was Esther. 14. In 2002, a rock climber named Ryan Hartley scaled the Transco Tower using a small pick. When he reached the 30th floor, almost halfway up, he jumped. On his broken body, they found a note protesting the war in Iraq. Presumably, he chose the Transco Tower because it was a symbol of Houston's oil boom. 64 stories of silver-black glass thrusting heavenward, alone in the middle of a retail and residential area, the tallest skyscraper ever built outside of a central business district. Pure energy shooting out of the center of the earth, as if a geyser of oil could be caught, purified, and transformed into a prism of light. As if anything could be that pure. Opposite the tower, across a rectangle of grass, stands the water wall fountain. A horseshoe-shaped artificial waterfall, exactly 64 feet tall, each foot representing one floor of the Transco Tower. Once we took the girls there after Christmas shopping at the Galleria. Jane, 3 at the time, pulled away from my hand and ran up to the edge of the water, and Tom took off running to catch up with her. Adventurous Jane stopped right at the bottom of the steps and looked straight up at the curved wall. Then, dizzied by the rushing water, she took a step forward. Her legs buckled under her. She sat down and let out a wail. Julie, 5, lay on the concrete, her head tipped back to see the giant arc of rushing water from a safe distance. While Tom gathered Jane up in his arms, I lay down next to Julie so that I could see what she saw. I remember her warm head nestled into my temple, her wispy hair blowing against my cheek. Together we listened to the sounds of Tom comforting Jane, barely audible over the noise from the waterfall. The water slammed down the wall so fast that it hardly looked like it was moving at all. When Julie spoke, her words went right into my ear.
"Mommy," she said, "is the sky falling down?"
I made a mental note to repeat it to Tom later that night after the girls went to bed, and said in a loud voice that the water noise turned into a whisper, "Don't worry, honey, it can't get us here." I felt, rather than saw, her brave little smile. Seen from a distance, silhouetted against the lit-up water wall and framed by a stone archway, they could be a couple taking engagement photos. Gretchen and Maxwell. Their hands clasped together, Gretchen leaning backward in a graceful bow shape against his weight. Then he jerks her forward like a dancer and clasps his arms around her, and they become one dark figure waltzing back and forth in front of the illuminated wall of water. But as I hurry toward them over wet grass that gets muddier closer to the fountain, I see her elbows angling out as she tries to push him away, his arms pinning them back down again. They are both fighting to get at her purse, which looks as if it has been wrapped around her neck in the struggle. I break into a run. I always forgot how loud the water wall is up close, a pounding roar that changes pitch and intensity with my every step, fading one moment into the background in the manner of white noise, then throbbing with renewed intensity. A mist fills the round concrete plaza in front of the curved wall of the fountain, making the ground treacherously slippery, and at night the light is a yellowish, jaundiced glow emanating from the underwater fountain lights. Just as I cross under the archway onto the plaza, the conjoined silhouettes tilt alarmingly and skid on their fulcrum. Gretchen stumbles backward over something lying on the ground, and then she's down, her head bouncing at the impact, Maxwell collapsing on top of her. He continues to flail for a moment like some deep-sea creature washed up on the shore, then pulls back, separating their bodies. A sliver of light outlines his beard and briefly illuminates a panicked snarl of animal rage on his face before he leans into the darkness, reaching for the purse that is now lying halfway under Gretchen's limp body on the wet concrete. "The man who did this to me." That's what she called Maxwell on the recording. I don't know what he did or who she is, but seeing his hand reach toward her motionless form, I know I have to stop what he's going to do next. I propel myself forward as hard as I can, and then my shoes are sliding on the wet concrete, just as Gretchen's did a moment before, and my feet slip out from under me. I manage to get my hand out in front of me and drop to one shin, but my teeth close on a millimeter of tongue when I hit the ground and a flower of heat spreads through my mouth. Maxwell sees me and springs to his feet, still straddling Gretchen's limp body. When he opens his mouth and speaks, his deep voice carries over the rushing of the water behind him, just as it carried over the sea of voices at the Circle of Healing.
"I know what this looks like," he says, panting. "But you don't know what this girl is capable of. She's dangerously disturbed. She lies. She's a killer."
"I don't believe you," I say, but I can't hear my own words, and I know that the lying part is true.
"She's been stalking me, making threats. She tried to blackmail me. She wants my money."
He gestures toward a duffel bag lying slumped on the wet ground a few feet away.
"She forced me to come here, threatened me, and then she attacked me."
I look down at the unmoving body on the concrete.
"I swear I was defending myself. She's got a gun in her purse."
But it's a mistake, because now I will never let him get that purse in his hands.
"If all she wants is your money, why would she attack you?"
He licks his lips.
"Like I said, she's disturbed. I'm successful. I help people."
His voice rises petulantly, his beard bulging over his Adam's apple.
"Girls like that can't stand a..."
"Girls like what?" He looks at me with a faint air of surprise.
"Whores."
I suck in my breath through clenched teeth.
"You don't talk about my daughter that way," I say.
And even though it isn't her, it suddenly is. He lunges for the purse, but I get to him first and push him into the trough at the base of the fountain with so much explosive force that the next thing I know, I'm kneeling in 6 inches of water on top of his chest. Behind me, his legs flail and jerk in the water, kicking toward my back, my head. But I am mostly in the air and he is mostly underwater, which makes me heavier temporarily. My knees are on his shoulders, and I can feel his hand grabbing for my hair. And good luck, motherfucker, I think. I cut it short when Julie was born. I gave it to motherhood, along with dangly earrings and peace of mind and the ability to not give a fuck about anyone and dreams of my own and a heart in my body. With my fingers snarled in his tangled hair, I slam his head on the bottom of the fountain as hard as I can, like punching through the bathroom door when I thought Julie was hurt on the other side. But the water puts up too much resistance, and what I get instead of a smack is a splash and a host of crazy shadows leaping up and careening away to the rhythm of my rage. Behind me, a voice cuts through the thundering water.
"John David!"
There's a click I recognize from my fantasies. In the split second that my grip relaxes, he is scrabbling backward, kicking me away until he's up against the water-covered slope. And then I see a look on Maxwell's face that says he wishes he hadn't kicked me away so quickly, and when I turn, I know why. Gretchen is standing, holding the gun. The pounding of the falling water is like a blank piece of paper, and the gun is the point of a pencil hovering a millimeter above it, sketching the three of us invisibly on the air before committing us to the page. Our bodies hold the corners of a triangle open. The man with his hands up in front of him, back pressed against the slope, water pouring over his shoulders and pummeling his neck so that his head shakes with the effort of steadiness. Me on one knee in the water, frozen in the act of rising. Gretchen standing with the gun.
Esther,
says Maxwell.
Please.
She ignores him, addresses me instead. He's right, you know. I've had sex for money more times than I can count. That makes me a whore. I've done a lot worse things, too. Lied and stolen from the people who loved me. Used them, left them. Julie, I say, forgetting. She snaps toward me and the gun flickers my way. When I flinch, the gun moves to Maxwell again. Don't call me that. I'm done with Julie. Something breaks off inside. It feels like a piece of my lungs, or like the water in the fountain is boiling and the skin is falling off my foot from the ankle down. That is all an exaggeration. What I should say is that it feels like all the parts of my body are going their separate ways. It feels like I am being abandoned by everything that has ever felt like a part of me. Maybe once you've been left by the most important person in your life, you can never be unleft again. Maybe you're destined to be abandoned even by your own guts. Maybe your foot walks off with your thigh bone. Why not? Stranger things have happened. Like, for example, right at this instant, Gretchen or Esther or whoever she is pointing the gun at Maxwell and saying words that make no sense. I went back to our old place, John David. It took me forever to figure out where it was. I couldn't remember what the house looked like from the outside, but it doesn't matter because it's not there anymore. Just an empty lot. Except for the police tape, and a cross, and a bunch of flowers and teddy bears. She pauses. I guess after you convinced me I killed Charlotte, you just bricked up the bunker and started over. God knows I've tried to do the same. Her face is already too wet from the spray in the air for me to see tears, but I can hear her gasping. But other people care about that dead girl in there. You should see all the candles. Nobody knows who she is, but they don't just smooth it over and move on. She takes a step forward. Neither do I. I didn't kill anyone. I'm not 13 anymore, and you can't tell me it's my fault. She takes another step forward and levels the gun. I won't let you.
Help me, Anna. Please help me,
Maxwell says, a couple of yards to my left. As unobtrusively as possible, I steady my foot on the bottom of the fountain.
Stay back,
she yells. Okay, I say. It feels like there's a wall between us, seething with metric tons of water that I have to push through. Gretchen. That gets her attention. Her head jerks toward me. I know who you are, and I know about Cal. I'm rising slowly to my feet. I know it was his. Maybe you love him, she says.
Don't.
I just want you to think about what you're doing. Think before you pull the trigger.
I've had plenty of time to think.
Me too, I say. I'm standing now, still in the water. I begin to slowly inch 1 foot forward. I don't think you're a killer.
I'm nothing.
But she's not nothing to me. For the past month, I've fed and clothed this girl. I've held her sobbing body on the bathroom floor. I've sat in waiting rooms praying for her to be okay, and I don't pray. I can't take my eyes off her now or the gun will go off. 1 foot is almost to the lip of the fountain. Every step I take toward her, her face looks younger and younger. I am fighting the wall, dragging my feet through her resistance as if it's a river running fast. You're my daughter. I am close enough to put a hand across her wrists. They are stone, untrembling. Julie, She shakes her head at me.
Anna,
she whispers with frightened eyes.
Mom.
I gently wrap my fingers around the muzzle of the gun, expecting any moment to feel a searing, scalding heat.
I'm not who you think I am,
she says, and I'm barely close enough to hear it.
Whoever you are, I love you,
I say. And then I have the gun in my hands, and I'm feeling for the safety, slowly and carefully, as I keep my eyes glued to hers.
And whatever he did, it's not worth ruining your life over.
He kidnapped Julie.
Her eyes are wide and blue.
Mom, it's him.
The words slow everything down, expanding the waterfall's roar around an eye of silence. At my feet, the duffel bag has burst open, and shiny stacks of paper are sliding out, dampening and unfolding in the mist. As the breeze flip-flops one of them over the concrete, I see that it's a church bulletin. Somewhere inside the eye of silence, Maxwell is screaming, "She's a liar, Anna!" But something she said a moment ago is ringing in my ears. The bunker. The police tape. Our old place. "I see you know my name," I say to him, and pull the trigger.
Esther was a virgin, an orphan girl living with her uncle Mordecai, but Esther was made for great things. One day the king Eliad called her to his palace, for he needed a new wife, and she was the most beautiful virgin in all the land. Esther was scared. She was only a girl. And she did not want to shame herself in the King of Light's palace in her dirty clothes. But she recognized the voice of God in the King of Light's call, and she knew that when the Lord calls, he must be obeyed. So she went to the king. He saw her and loved her immediately, but he refused to touch her. "Your garments are dirty," he said. "You must not defile my bed." What happened then?
Esther wept for shame.
Esther wept for shame, but the King of Light said, "Don't cry, my child. Have faith in the Lord, and one day you will be cleaner and more beautiful than you have ever imagined." And what did she think?
She thought he must be mistaken.
Because?
Because she was unworthy.
But?
She did not question the King of Light.
Why?
Because he spoke with the Lord's voice.
"What must I do?" Esther asked. "You must live in the palace with my concubines for a year," he said. Esther heard the Lord's voice in the commands of the king, and she knew that the Lord must be obeyed. So she bowed her head and went to live with the concubines. The concubines bathed and perfumed her and braided her hair. For a year they did not clothe her so that she would learn humility. They taught her ways of pleasing the King of Light. They beat her when she spoke, but never left a scar. She never thought of running away, for she was willing to endure all for the love of the King of Light, who was chosen of the Lord. How did she feel?
She felt so alone, she felt like she was dead.
But?
But she knew that her clay was being shaped for the Spirit.
So?
So she endured.
Other maidens were sent to the house of the concubines, and she saw them weep and complain, and some of them fled. But in the whole year, Esther never wept a single tear. And though other maidens were sent to the King of Light's bed, Esther knew they had not pleased him, for they returned to the house of concubines afterward, and became the king's slaves. One day a year after she had first seen the King of Light, he called her to his bed. He was so pleased with her that he chose her to be his queen, the Queen of Light. And from that day forward she has been God's chosen.
What does she do? She follows the Lord's commandments.
How?
She listens to her king.
Who is her king?
The King of Light.
Who is she?
The Queen of Light.
Is she happy?
This was the part she got wrong at first. Too many times. She had a round red spot on the inside of her upper arm from the first time, purple and faded. The new ones were on the insides of her thighs. But not today.
Is she happy?
No.
Why isn't she happy?
The Lord does not want her to be happy.
What does he want?
He wants her to be good.
And?
He wants her to be clean.
And?
He He wants her to be beautiful.
She is, Esther. She is. And then she closed her eyes.
The part that always came next,